Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Old Fox, Young Fox, where two worlds collide over business issues we all face, with your hosts, Oliver Happy and Jeremy Woolwich. This episode is brought to you by Independent Perspective, a strategic and creative UK-based consultancy. For a fresh perspective on your business, head over to independentperspective.co.
So I suggest we start.
So what are we going to talk about today, Jeremy?
Well, Ollie, something very close to my heart. I've always had this interest in behaviour, sort of behavioural insights, organisational behaviour, organisational culture. And I'm very conscious that in the last couple of weeks, there have been two big things that have hit the news. One is the whole thing around sexual harassment, which has been cutting a swathe through Hollywood and Silicon Valley and Washington. And, you know, there's been an impact here as well, which I think is really interesting. And the second thing that's come to the fore is this whole thing about equality in the workplace, and particularly around pay, and you've got the BBC and all the stuff that's been going on there. And the thing that's in common with both of these things is women, and it's the role of women. And it's becoming much, much more prevalent. And it just seems to me there's been a bit of a paradigm shift. We become much more aware of, or in the mainstream, become much more aware that women are sort of rising to the top of organisations. And I'm interested to know how that's changing the workplace and if and how organisations are adapting to those changes. And for those of us, or for those organisations that haven't really had to address this yet, or feel they haven't had to address it yet, what do they need to be aware of? I've met Jo, and I just thought Jo would be a great person to talk to us about this and give her feedback from some of her experiences. Jo's actually in leadership and development and organisational development and individual development. And I just thought that Jo would have an interesting perspective on it. And also, she's female. So Jo, I think I've got that bit right. Would you like just to tell us a little bit about who you are and your background and your business and what you do?
Indeed, yes, thank you. And thank you for hosting me today. So my background is that I was originally an engineer in BT at a time when women didn't do that kind of thing. So I'm going back to the 80s. And it was a very interesting time because women had to put up with a lot more then than they're prepared to put up with now. I've been in the world of learning and development as it now is since the late 80s and running my own business since the mid 90s. And one of the things that I'm really focusing on now is the whole issue of how women now step up into their power. And I'm particularly focused at women over 48 because they have their own challenges and there is a particular seam of expertise there that I believe we're not mining effectively. My area of focus really being individual, group and organisation development is one that will never be done, will never be completed. So there is a lot of work to be done. And I was fascinated to hear Jeremy's introduction talk about being more aware. I immediately scribbled down on a piece of paper, but, because yes, you're right, we're more aware, but being more aware doesn't automatically lead to action. And I think that's going to be the nature of our conversation. So you'll have gathered by my introduction, very squarely in the old fox category.
Well, I was just about to ask you that. Do you definitely feel that you are old fox rather than young fox?
I am very definitely old fox and proud to be so. And because of the work I do, I'm still in touch right the way through to young fox. I've done quite a lot of work in the Middle East. And, you know, it's one culture where being a woman of a certain age, proudly sporting grey hair, works in my favour.
Very good. Is being an old fox an age thing, or is it an attitudinal thing?
Yeah, I think it's part age, part attitudinal from my perspective. So I know quite a few mid-foxes who have lost the will, have
to
lost... lost belief, and this is where my particular focus on females maybe comes in, but have lost belief in themselves and believe that they don't have anything to contribute and kind of life is over. So they're looking, I won't say forward, but they're looking ahead towards retirement with a sinking feeling in their heart. Whereas I also know some amazing women in their 70s and beyond who, if you heard them talk, if you read some of what they produce, you would say, that's a young fox. But from an age perspective, they're not. Attitudinally, mindset, they certainly are.
So can I take it from what you've said that you think that this idea of, that we've got within the notion of old fox, young fox is actually quite pertinent and quite relevant at the moment, this integrating young and old thinking?
It is. I mean, some of the organisations I'm working with at the moment have a particular crisis coming up in that they're losing a lot of the older talent and they haven't necessarily been doing the work to bring along the young foxes as they need to do. And I think it's important that we begin that integration right at the outset, because if we're to believe everything we hear about millennials, they are quite different in their outlook and approach to some of the older generations. And we need to get each generation valuing each other. So it's not a question of the olders ought to value the youngsters or vice versa. So I think we need to do that integration piece in organisations right from the outset.
Have you experienced many organisations that actually are proactively doing that currently? Or is this an aspiration?
There are a few. But I think what kicks in is something that is very hard to shift, which is unconscious bias. As soon as I find myself working with that, I know it's going to be a harder shift in order to make changes in any organisation, because what we're looking at is the whole culture of the organisation. And I frequently, in the work I do, talk to managers and even talk to some of the new joiners about the fact that, you know, when you're engaged by any new organisation, they engage you because you're bright, you have aspirations, you want to make a difference, you want to contribute. And yet in a very short space of time, what happens is you go, in my language, they go native. So they look around and kind of go, why am I being like this? And so then that leads us into the whole employee engagement problem. And unless someone picks that up really early on and keeps them engaged, as soon as they start to go native, then the writing is on the wall, really.
We were having a conversation earlier about the recruitment processes. In particular, a lot of it seems to be going online now. So you have to start by filling out an application online. Do you think this idea of bias is within the sort of algorithms that are used within a lot of these programs? So we're building in this propensity against recruiting older people, people with more experience or whatever?
That's a tough one to answer, and I know that I know the answer to that. I happen to be doing some work at the moment with one of the big law firms in London on a restart program, which is about actively helping the over 50s get back into employment. And a lot of what they're doing is online. They're doing their own video, CVs, they're doing all that sort of stuff. So I think it's well accepted now that that is the way forward. So if I go back even 5 years, probably the perception was that people of a certain age couldn't manage a computer, couldn't do things online. That is shifting so much. And there are some wonderful stories about, you know, grandparents in their 80s and 90s still Skyping and, and WhatsApping and FaceTiming with their grandkids and their great grandkids. So I don't know the answer to your question, Jeremy. What I do know is that older generation are way more tech savvy than we've probably given them credit for.
Very good. And can you tell me, in your experience, how do men and women differ in terms of leadership style, behaviour in the workplace? Is it real or is it a stereotype?
Oh, the million-dollar question. I can share with you my experience, some of which seems to be borne out. And that is that women generally seem to have a lower opinion of themselves and their ability. So, and this works through whatever age range, whether I'm working with new recruits or whether I'm working up into kind of partners in one of the big, you know, big law firms or accountancy practices. And one of the things, if we go back to applying for positions or applying for jobs, one of the things I have noticed is that if a man sees a job advert and he can meet 50% of the criteria, he'll say, oh, yeah, come on, then let's give that a go. If a woman sees a job advert, be it external or an internal promotion, And there are one or two things that she doesn't have quite enough experience of. She'll count herself out. She'll rule herself out of that process. So there is something very, very, it seems to be very, now that's a huge generalization. That's not going to apply to all men and all women. But there does seem to be something that where females are more cautious. And if we go way back, then that may be down to the kind of, you know, nurturing, caregiving role that we had as mothers and carers for the family. And men being the hunter-gatherer providers needed to get out there and show some bravado in order to get what they wanted. And even though sort of we've moved on from those times, I think those behaviours are still somewhat embedded.
And what other aspects of the sort of the nurturing aspects of women do you think has been brought into the workplace with their increasing involvement?
Women are on the whole different leaders and managers, in that many that, and again this isn't a universal at all, but many that I work with are more comfortable with emotions, are more comfortable with being able to listen to whatever ails or whatever one of their team members brings to the table. And men are still somewhat uncomfortable with it. Now, we know that emotional intelligence is now being taught in schools. So we're about to have a generation leap into the workplace who have more of an understanding of emotions, how to name them, how to express them, how to express them appropriately, how to contain when appropriate, that is going to be quite baffling to some of the managers who are managing and leading them. So I think there is a potential, I won't say crisis coming up, but there's going to be an interesting time coming up when some of those younger people coming into the workplace aren't going to understand why some of the older managers don't get them, why they're not comfortable to hear whatever emotion they want to express.
And so how do you think things are different for women in the workplace now compared to, say, 10, even 20 years ago?
10, 20 years ago, we hadn't long come off, you know, another major recession. And I think those times are always really interesting because people's behaviour changes in order to be safe. So 10, 20 years ago, I think women, and certainly my experience at that stage, was that women were less prepared to speak out. I mean, some of the stories that I could tell you of my early years would have youngsters' toes curling now. And yet it was the norm. It was accepted. And because I was a female in a male-dominated environment, there was also this pressure that said, well, if you can't cut it, you know, if you can't handle it, it's only banter, it's only a joke. So women put up with it. I think with certainly the Me Too campaign, with the whole Harvey Weinstein thing, you know, being surfaced now, women are braver about speaking up and speaking out. And sometimes the organisations don't have the capacity, the processes, the capability to actually know how to deal with that. So women are braver. Younger women now, you know, and I have told a few of those stories to younger women, and you know, their response is extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. And if I put myself in their shoes, sort of back then, I wouldn't have been bold and brave in the way that they are saying they would be. Now, whether they would, we don't know.
I mean, the other things that usually associated with a female style is this idea that they're better at multitasking than men. They're more collaborative than men and less competitive than men. Is there any truth in any of that?
It's dangerous in that we are stereotyping in a way, and often I'm working with groups and individuals looking at their particular personality type, some of which both for male and female is more collaborative, some of which is more insular, more solo in the way they prefer to operate. However, there are trends within that that say, yes, women are more collaborative. Yes, women are less competitive. And the whole multitasking thing has been debunked somewhat, in that apparently we can have several things on the go, but actually, if you look at the kind of neuroscience of it, we are actually only focusing on one thing at a time, but we have more balls in the air. We may be juggling more things, but what we're better at doing maybe is switching attention from one thing to another. And ironically, that doesn't always lead to effectiveness or productivity.
It seems that women in particular are rising to the top of certain sorts of industry. For example, the legal profession, IT, some of the communication sort of industries. Less so perhaps in some of the more sort of engineering-y, processy type areas. Mm-hmm. What's that about? Is that just an inbuilt resistance in those sectors, or are they, I mean, why would they particularly be more successful in some areas than others?
I'd like to say it's short term. I'm not so sure it is. I mean, only recently there was an article in one of the building journals that still was talking about how much harassment there is for women in that industry. And having come up through that, but through the kind of engineering field, women often have to prove themselves to be more capable than a male in order to get noticed and promoted. This is where I think the unconscious bias kicks in again. I think, and this is my opinion, but I think people are really nervous about employing women, because what they do is they kind of think about, is there a potential, you know, sexual harassment case looming here? Is this woman going to leave and have babies? So we know that they're not allowed to ask questions like that at interview anymore, thank goodness. But it also makes an awful lot of sense, and in a way that they have those concerns. So some of the smaller organisations, it can really affect if a female in a fairly notable position goes off on maternity leave. In the larger organisations, of course, they've got the capacity to carry it. So I think it hits the smaller organisations more than it does the larger organisations. Plus, the larger organisations tend to have the whole HR function and, you know, in-house lawyers, all that sort of stuff. So they know what they're dealing with when it comes to things like the 2010 Equality Act.
That's really interesting, because almost all the examples you just gave, I have heard uttered by senior folks during the hiring process in the last, say, 5 or 10 years. And yeah, it's quite interesting, being what I would like to think is a reasonably progressive chap. And I apologize for the sirens. It sounds like the seagulls have been joined with sirens today down on the sunny coast. I found it quite difficult because I don't understand where they're coming from. If someone says, I don't want to hire her because she's only going to have babies soon anyway, I just think to myself, why is that even a factor? However, it is a factor.
I'm totally sympathetic. I mean, I was brought up with three sisters and a very strong mother. So I don't have any difficulties at all about the notion that women can have leadership roles and so on and so forth. So having said that, I went to an all-boys boarding school, which has other consequences. But in the workplace, I have no difficulty with having a female boss. But equally, I was at a smaller engineering company earlier in the week, where essentially it's run by three people in a market which is highly competitive. They're struggling, there's a lack of confidence. For them to have somebody, a female, leave to go and have a baby, financially they just could not afford it. So when you've got those really, really practical issues that you've got to address, how do you make it easy for them to understand that it's in their own vested self-interest in ensuring that the workplace is suitable and can accommodate those sort of circumstances?
And I'm not sure I have the answer to that one, Jeremy, because, you know, again, that is one of the most important questions. I think it's easier to make it happen when it's a larger organisation, when you have scale. In those smaller organisations, they are always going to be looking at, can we survive this? Can we keep going through this? And that's why even if a very well qualified and appropriate female put herself forward in that process, I think she'd be less likely still, even these days, to get an interview, or if she got an interview, to get selected, because there would be those nagging doubts.
Even though that organisation might be ever so well intentioned and be absolutely sympathetic to the idea of bringing women into the organisation, they might just perceive it as being too much of a risk.
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes even if they would go to advisors, the advisors may end up saying, well, let's look at the risk of this. What can you do to mitigate it? What might be your contingent actions? And they may be things that the smaller organization can't afford either. So, you know, I think we are a really long way away still from this being shifted, which is why right at the outset, when you said more aware, my initial response was yes, but the reality of us really having equality in all that means, we're a long way from that.
So if you're in the shoes of a small SME engineering company, what would your advice be to them in terms of how they need to start thinking or adapting? Because in the end, legislation is going to be evident, and you know the workplace mm-hmm. is changing quite significantly. And also, a lot of the perceived disadvantages with employing women, like, for example, maternity leave, is being extended to men as well anyway, and yes, the talent shortage.
Paternity leave.
Yeah. So yeah. At some point, the rubber's going to hit the road, and they're going to be facing this sort of thing. How do they start to prepare for it?
I think it's about having a radical rethink of the way they're structured and what it means to actually to be an employee and to work in a place like that. So I remember, back in the early 90s, probably reading a book and seeing a video about a chap called Ricardo Semler. Ricardo Semler, Brazilian business that made white goods or components for white goods, I seem to remember. And he handed over kind of autonomy to the workers. So they decided when they came to work. They decided kind of how they were paid for things. So any board decision that was made, the workers had a vote on it. Now, that's quite an extreme version. But what happened is that people stepped up. Now, the great fear, of course, is that people will say, oh, they'll just, you know, they'll take advantage of the situation. They're, you know, they won't pull their weight. They do that. Actually, if you believe in the inherent goodness in the human spirit and you reward people appropriately, you will be astonished by what people will step up and deliver. So I think it's about helping organizations relook at what it means to work. So where can people work from home more appropriately? Why do hours have to be 8 till 5 or 9 till 6 or whatever they have to be? If you give people autonomy and say, how could we structure this role so that it may work for you and that, you know, and almost future-proof it so that work can still be done, I think that's the radical step that we have to start looking at.
Interestingly, in regard to the Ricardo Semler example, what was really interesting about that is that it was extremely successful for him. And as I understand it, he set it up with the intention of it being an example to other organisations, and he wanted the state or whatever to promote this way of working. And whilst he's been brilliant in terms of on the lecture circuit and people going to visit him and so on, as far as I understand it, not many people have actually followed his lead. And I mean, clearly it's just another level of risk that's being introduced. And when you've got shareholders who are outside the business just looking at a short-term return, there seem to be all these sort of other external factors that prevent innovation. And it seems that we've got to start educating at that level rather than just within the organisation.
Agreed. Very few people took up Ricardo Semler's model from a perspective of fear.
Yeah.
How will our workforce react, respond without even testing it? What would our shareholders say? And so what happens is we then get stuck in the old management model and structure of an organization rather than being brave and taking things forward into the next century.
And where are the other areas of innovation that you've seen, if any, Joe?
I'm not sure I've seen too many other areas of real innovation. And ironically, you've now hit on something that is a bit of a hot button for me, Jeremy. I'm a big fan of Professor Curtin's work around creativity. And Curtin talks about the importance of understanding creativity on a continuum. that stretches from adaptation at one end through to innovation at another end. And we've become obsessed with innovation. And true innovation is literally completely rethinking things, throwing baby out with bathwater, all that sort of stuff. When actually what organizations need to do is be more adaptive and actually make those small but significant changes, the small gains that we often hear and often talk about. And there is a time and a place for innovation. There is a time and a place for adaptation. And often it's the innovation that scares the bejeebers out of people. And if we could tackle it from an adaptation perspective in terms of what are the small things that we could change that would be moving us in the right direction, because often those are also easier to bear by the people who are impacted by it than the whole new world, whole new way of doing things.
And I'm assuming this is one of the areas that you lead and you coach organisations in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Very good. Very good.
We just agreed that I was going to speak next.
Oh, sorry.
Didn't we?
That's democracy in action. Do you want to add something on?
Well, thank you, Jeremy. I'm glad you asked. So, you know, I've really seen that in action in terms of what are the small things that we can do, just to bring it back to the gender equality and emergence of women in mm-hmm. the workforce question. And I've seen really small startups and the tech business, obviously where everything is new and the HR system is new and the payroll is new. But in terms of working at a marketing team where half of the team are women, and of those people, the majority are working part-time because of pickups and drop-offs at school. Mm-hmm. Talking to some of the finance people behind those decisions and saying to them, well, you know, you own 25% of the company. How do you feel about that as we look to hire one other person into the team? And just some really good perspectives on that are coming through from those people, in that they would say, what is an hour? They're online later in the evening anyway. Mm-hmm. If they don't do that, we'll lose them and we'll have to go and find someone else.
Well, of course, absolutely. You know, the business was designed on a model created in the sort of 18th century, 18th, 19th century, for, you know, sort of factory type situations, not for a 21st century business, which is essentially about knowledge and creativity. So we have to start reinventing and remodeling these sort of things.
You're right. And in and of itself, it's a very masculine model. It suits males and it doesn't really suit females at all.
Ollie, have you ever worked under a female boss?
Yeah, certainly have.
How does that differ? How did you experience that as a...
Well, I think I should put it in context and say that it was in marketing. And I think marketing is particularly interesting because people think it's creative, but it's actually analytical. And the personalities involved in those teams, those that had the analytics and the approach to go through things carefully, did very, very well. And in my experience, my female bosses have had those characteristics. And so they were incredibly successful and exactly who I wanted in those roles. Some of the men that I've reported to over different times have been a little bit less organized, a little bit less data-driven. Now, whether that's worth applying to all of men and women, I don't know.
Or all of marketing organisations, because my view is that marketing would be an integration of both the analytical and the creative. And I think actually, I wouldn't limit that to marketing. I think all roles should be an integrated, you should be working on them in an integrated way, both left and right brain and all that sort of stuff. Women, as I understand it, are more collaborative. Would that be? And they would be more likely to encourage a more collaborative approach, and it seems to me that that's also more pertinent nowadays.
I think again we have to be slightly wary of this, in that some women absolutely are very collaborative, as are some men. So rather than look at it in terms of that being a gender stereotype, I prefer to look at it in terms of a personality type. So whether we look at something like Strengths Insight or MBTI or Bolton and Bolton, you know, all of those tools, all of those models will show you that actually men and women are very different in very different ways. So if we just talk about the work of Bolton and Bolton for a moment, they help you understand working styles in four different quadrants. Now, there has to be a word of caution here, because often as soon as people hear somebody say that, they think, oh, don't put me in a box. You know, you can't define me like that. But actually, if I observed anyone's behaviour over any length of time, I would pick up certain habitual responses, habitual behaviours that would give me an idea of their preferences. And the four quadrants that they identify through those behaviours are, one, a driver quadrant. Now, somebody who has driver as their main preference is somebody who's very results driven, who is often quite brusque and will get straight to the point. They don't do the fluffy stuff. They don't particularly want to be asked whether they had a nice weekend. They want to get down to business. And what matters for them is productivity and results. If we then look at one of the other quadrants, the expressive quadrant, this is somebody who's a much bigger picture thinker. They don't really like detail at all. They want to be the creative one who comes up with the big ideas. They rely on other people to then backfill with the detail.
I think I'm blushing at this point.
and create something that works. One of the other quadrants is the amiable. And the amiable is somebody who is very collaborative, who actually makes sure that everyone is involved, who makes sure that people are okay, that people are happy, and they're very uncomfortable with conflict. And the fourth quadrant is the analytical. And this is somebody who is very data driven. If they had an office door, they would like it shut. So they like to be heads down, really into the detail. They like to be given time to think about something that's asked of them. They won't necessarily come straight back with a response. And what's so important to them is accuracy. So we have those four quadrants. And if you imagine them just as a Boston 2x2 matrix, top right, we have driver. Underneath that, we have expressive. Bottom left, we have amiable. Top, we have analytical. And if I could choose a team, I would have representation from right the way across those four quadrants. And what I need to be aware of is there will be tensions within that team just by me being me. So me being me as an amiable, which I happen to be, and I like collaboration. I like to make sure that things are working well. I'm a really great listener. I'm a really great coach. But sometimes what that means is I put other people first, and therefore I have to stay late to do my own work, for instance. A driver looks across at that and says, come on, get down to it. Why are you late delivering stuff? The expressive, who is very big picture, sits in a meeting with an analytical who wants to go into chapter and verse and give all the detail and the backup stats. And they're away looking out the window, thinking about their next creative idea. So across the diagonal in both of those, the tension or the potential for conflict is huge. So part of my role is getting people to appreciate the value that each of those quadrants bring rather than the frustration that they may be experiencing right now. Because when you get those four quadrants working together, you have a magic team.
And which of those profiles is best suited to coordinate and manage that team?
Any of them can do it perfectly well. And because the magic of that is learning how to flex. So if I'm an analytical who happens to be a team leader, I need to understand that my preference is probably solo working behind a closed door, making sure that everything's right. So my learning edge, if you like, is to step out from that office and to make sure that I'm there for my people. Every one of them is very capable. If you look back over time and history, leaders, great leaders of the world, you'll find them in each and every one of those quadrants.
But the flex can be taught or it's inherent?
Taught. Our natural preference, with the exception maybe of the amiable, because they can be a bit too like a reed in the breeze, in that they can flex sometimes too much and lose their sense of self. But from my understanding and my experience working for years with this with people is that the rest has to be taught. So a great way to really get this sort of surfaced is to run a team day where you get people to self-position and you see the lights go on for people and you hear team members say, that's why there's tension between us. So now we've got a language with which we can understand that. And we can then ensure that each and every one of us is flexing. So it's not a question of the leader or the manager being the one who always flexes. What we do is encourage each to flex to the middle so that actually there is now a good working alliance.
So that's super interesting, because we've set out to talk about the role of women in the workplace and a survival guide for women in the workplace. But what I'm hearing is that actually the personality type and managing for that and hiring for that could be more important than focusing on the gender of a person.
From my perspective, absolutely, absolutely right. Yeah. So I think that's the kind of the nub of the issue, in a way, is understanding that.
And would you also say that, sorry, Jeremy, I know you're about to say something.
That's fine.
I managed to get him first. would you say that over time, if we look at, say, the 80s and 90s, that in general, the personality type deemed to be the best leader most of the time may have been a driver, and that that may be changing over time now?
Absolutely. And, you know, I was reflecting as I was talking earlier that my experience of female leaders in the 80s was very shoulder pads and driver tendency. In fact, women were encouraged to do that. Women were led to believe that the only way to get on and to rise through was to actually grow a bigger pair than their male counterparts. So that was what was really encouraged. We are now at a completely different place, where in the 80s and even some of the 90s, once a woman made it, she was more likely to draw up the ladder behind her rather than encourage other women to come up behind her. What we see nowadays much more is women being prepared to promote and have the backs of their women colleagues.
So I have to say, whilst I agree with your premise that says in broad terms, you can actually identify certain common characteristics, I love this notion that says people are more complex than that. And that
absolutely.
And that we are, you know, we are all a bit more difficult to manage. I've always had this interest in behaviour. I just thought Jo would be a great person to talk to us about this. And also, she's female.
So you'll have gathered by my introduction, very squarely in the old fox category.
Well, I was just about to ask you that. Do you definitely feel that you are old fox rather than young fox?
I am very definitely old fox and proud to be so.
And I apologise for the sirens. It sounds like the seagulls have been joined with sirens today down on the sunny coast.
That's democracy in action.